Have you ever, been in a situation where a casual agreement, totally went sideways?
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Like, maybe a friend's was all, "Oh, yeah, I'll help you with that project." Or, like, a family member was like, "Oh, I'll totally invest in your thing."
And then
And then things just got, complicated.
complicated, yeah.
Well, that's exactly the kind of situation that we're going to dive into today.
Ooh, exciting.
It's this case, Aztec International Foods, Inc. v. Duenas.
Okay.
And it's from 2013, so not too long ago, not ancient history or anything.
Right, yeah, very relevant.
Yeah, very relevant. It's from the 12th Appellate District in Claremont County, Ohio.
Okay.
And what's really interesting about this case is it really shows how fraud law, that whole thing, how it can actually come into play
Yeah.
even when business deals start out super informally.
Yeah, I think that's what's so interesting about this case, right? Because, especially for, our listeners who are, future lawyers, you have to realize how dangerous these undocumented partnerships can be.
Totally, especially I feel like with family,
Oh, especially with family. Exactly. Because, there's that extra level of trust. And so you're like, oh, it'll be fine. It's family.
Oh, it's cool. We don't need a contract. We're family.
Exactly. But as we see in this case, that can go really, really wrong. And that's why I think this deep dive is so important. I mean, it'll highlight those risks, but we'll also kind of, give some takeaways, some practical tips
Exactly.
for when you're advising small businesses or family ventures later on.
Yeah, that's what we're all about here, taking these cases and making them
Marketing.
real, making them
Optimal. Yeah.
actionable, applicable.
Absolutely.
So, at the center of all of this legal drama is this Mexican restaurant. It was called Los Cabos in Amelia, Ohio. So, back in 2003, we have this guy, Ricardo Ruano, and he teams up with his uncle,
Okay.
Octavio Duenas. Okay.
Got it.
And then they also bring in RFJ, Inc., which was a company that belonged to Ruano's cousin, Ramon Michel,
Okay.
and his brothers. So from the beginning, their whole operational style was very, let's just say, relaxed.
Relax. I love that. Yeah. I mean, when I was reading this case, I was like, relax is putting it lightly. I mean, the court even said, and I'm just going to quote this directly, none of the parties involved in the formation of Aztec and its operation of Los Cabos had any firm idea what they were doing. Apparently, relied upon a series of informal transactions and agreements.
Yikes.
Right? I mean, imagine trying to build a successful business on just vague understandings and handshakes
In the vibes.
and good vibes, exactly.
Yeah.
But, as you can probably guess, this whole lack of formal agreements, regarding ownership, responsibilities, who was contributing what,
Right, all the important stuff.
all the important stuff that you would think you'd want to, hash out.
Yeah, especially when you're starting a business.
Especially when you're starting a
Yeah,
business.
especially when it's with family,
Yeah, exactly.
you would think.
You would think.
But anyway, so, this lack of agreement, really just kind of set the stage for all these future disputes that arose. And it turned out that, the legal ownership structure of Aztec, the company they formed,
Right.
didn't match up at all with what they had all just kind of informally agreed on.
And in law, that's where things get messy because anytime you have these informal understandings clashing with the actual legal realities,
Oh, yeah.
you just open the door for so many problems. And in this case, it led to allegations of fraud, which is exactly what we're digging into with Aztec v. Duenas.
So, like the heart of this whole dispute, right? It was about some restaurant equipment.
Okay.
So, Michelle, the cousin, he was like, "Oh, yeah, I personally paid for all this equipment." But, plot twist, the real story was that RFJ, Inc., that company he was part of,
Right.
they actually used a rebate program to get that equipment.
Interesting. So he's kind of like taking credit for something
Yeah,
that.
it was being a little shady, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So that's where the problem is.
Yeah. And so, this whole, difference between what Michelle was claiming and the reality of how the equipment was actually paid for,
Right.
that became like the key issue in this whole fraud claim.
I see.
Because Ruano, remember, he's the one who went into business with his uncle.
Right.
He believed Michelle,
Right.
right? And he paid Michelle $75,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's break down, this alleged fraud.
Yeah, let's get into the nitty-gritty, the legal stuff.
Exactly. Because, for our listeners who are studying for the bar or just, really getting into torts,
Yeah, those torts classes.
yeah, you have to remember that proving fraud under Ohio law, it's not enough to just show that someone, said something that wasn't true.
Right. There's a higher standard.
There's a whole specific set of elements that you have to be able to prove.
Yes.
So you need to be able to show that there was this misrepresentation or concealment of a fact and that this fact was material. And then you have to show that this fact was actually false, that the person who said it knew it was false.
They knew they were lying, basically.
Basically, yeah. Intent to deceive. And then that the other person relied on this false information and they were justified in relying on it. And then because of this reliance, they suffer damages.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, right? It's a whole process.
It's a whole thing.
But that's the law.
But it's important, you know, because you have to protect people.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So Aztec v. Duenas is a really good example of how these elements of fraud can actually play out, especially in these informal business situations.
Okay. Yeah. Let's walk through them.
Okay. So the first element, misrepresentation. Mm. Michelle, he specifically said, I paid for this equipment.
Right.
But we know that that wasn't true.
Right. Because the evidence showed that RFJ, Inc., with their little rebate program.
Yeah, that's how they got the equipment.
That's how they paid for it.
Exactly.
Okay, so misrepresentation, check.
Check.
What about materiality? So was this fact actually important?
Well, yeah, and that's the interesting thing. Ruano testified, and he was like, yeah, it really mattered to me who I was paying back, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Like, he wanted to make sure that the right person or the right company was getting that money for the investment that they made.
Yeah, know? Totally.
So even though it might seem simple, it's legally super significant when you're trying to analyze if fraud happened.
Totally. Yeah, because it goes to show that this lie, this misrepresentation, actually influenced Ruano's decision.
Exactly.
Okay, what's next?
So then we have falsity. So we know that Michelle knew. He knew that it was actually RFJ who paid for that equipment.
Right. He knew about the rebate.
He knew about the rebates.
Yeah.
So from that, the court was basically like, okay, that means he intended to deceive Ruano.
Right, because if he knew the truth about the rebate program,
yeah,
and he still said he paid for it himself,
yeah, obviously.
Yeah, that can only mean that he was trying to mislead Ruano on purpose.
Yeah.
Okay, and then there's reliance, which I think in this case is extra interesting because of the whole family dynamic.
Yeah, because they're cousins, right?
Exactly. So the court took into account that Ruano didn't have a ton of experience in business, and also that there's this inherent trust that you have with family.
Yeah.
So they were like, okay, in this specific situation, it was reasonable for Ruano to believe Michelle.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't just some random guy off the street, you know.
Exactly. It was his cousin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like he was just being naive or anything. It's like, you know, you trust your family.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so because Ruano believed this lie, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He paid the $75,000. So that right there, boom, those are the damages.
The damages, okay.
The actual, like, financial harm that he suffered.
Right. So it's important to remember, though, right, that the burden of proof for fraud, it's a pretty high bar to clear. You need what they call clear and convincing evidence.
Yeah, I remember learning about this in evidence class.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's tougher than just the usual standard, right?
Way tougher. In most civil cases, you just need what they call a preponderance of the evidence. So basically, more likely than not.
1%, right.
Yeah, more than 50%. But with fraud, it's not enough. The evidence has to be strong enough to really convince the judge or the jury that what you're saying is true.
Yeah, like no doubt about it.
Right, exactly.
So in a case like this, you know, where it really comes down to, you know, he said, she said, the trial court's decision about who's telling the truth, that's really, really important.
It's huge. Yeah. And in Aztec v. Duenas, the appellate court, they basically just went along with what the trial judge decided about the witnesses and what really happened.
They deferred. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they were the ones, you know, in the courtroom seeing these people.
They saw the whites of their eyes.
Exactly. Exactly. So in fraud cases, you know, it's all about credibility.
Credibility.
Yeah. Okay, so now we get to the really juicy part.
Yes, the opinions.
The opinions, the different perspectives.
Let's hash it out.
Okay, so we have the majority opinion, the concurring opinion, and then we have this dissenting opinion. So three different views on the same situation.
So much to unpack.
Exactly. So let's start with the main one, the majority opinion, which was written by Judge Hendrickson.
Okay.
So they really zeroed in on the fact that Michelle knew about the rebate program and he still told Ruano that he had paid for the equipment himself. And I love that they even quoted him in the opinion. They said, Michelle knew RFJ paid for the equipment, yet represented personal investment.
Ooh, burn.
Right.
They called him out.
They totally called him out. So for the majority, you know, that was basically the smoking gun.
Like, end of story.
End of story. Michelle lied. Ruana believed him. Boom. Fraud.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Okay. So now we have the concurring opinion.
The concurrence. Okay. So this one was written by Judge Powell.
Right.
And they agreed that fraud happened, like the majority.
Mm-hmm.
But what they really wanted to emphasize was how this whole mess could have been totally avoided.
If they had just put it in writing.
Exactly. If they had been more formal, if they had documented their agreements, none of this would have ever gone to court.
Right, yeah.
So Judge Powell is basically giving us all a lesson here.
Write it down, people.
Write it down. Yeah. Because proper documentation can save you a lot of trouble.
So much time, so much money, so much heartache.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, so last but not least, we have the dissenting opinion.
The dissent. Okay, this one is interesting because it gives us a completely different angle.
Yeah.
This opinion was written by Judge Piper.
Right.
And their main argument was that, you know, when you have these informal situations, it can be really hard to actually prove that someone was intentionally trying to deceive someone else.
Because, you know, informality.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, maybe there was some miscommunication. Maybe things were just unclear.
Right.
So Judge Piper was basically saying that because there weren't any formal agreements and everything was so casual, there was enough doubt to question whether Michelle was actually trying to trick Ruano.
Makes sense.
So for the dissent, informality, it creates this kind of cloud of ambiguity that makes it really hard to pin down fraudulent intent.
Interesting. So we have these three opinions.
Three different perspectives.
Yeah, but what does it all mean? You know, like, why should we care about this case?
That's the million-dollar question, right? I think this case is important for a few reasons.
Okay, lay it on me.
First of all, it shows that fraud can happen even in those informal settings. It doesn't matter if it's family, if it's friends, if it's a relaxed business deal. The law still applies.
Yeah, you can't just be like, oh, it's cool, we're family.
Exactly.
But the law is going to come for you.
The law doesn't care about your personal relationships. If you lie to someone to get their money, that's fraud.
Fraud is fraud.
Fraud is fraud.
Period.
Exactly. And the second takeaway, I think this is so important for our listeners. Document everything.
Write it down.
Write it down.
Yeah, I feel like we keep coming back to this.
I know, but it's so important, especially when you're starting a business. Doesn't matter if it's with your best friend, your sibling, your parent. Get everything in writing.
Your cousin.
Especially your cousin, like in this case.
Especially your cousin, yeah.
Because it can save you so much trouble later on.
And legal fees.
Oh, yeah. Don't even get me started on legal fees. It's not worth it. Just write it down.
Okay. So for our future lawyers out there, what are some of the things that they should keep in mind when advising clients?
Okay. So first of all, you always have to hammer home that documentation is key.
Yes.
Like we said, write it down, formalize those agreements. And second, they need to understand that in these fraud cases, intent can be really hard to prove directly.
Yeah, because you can't just, you know, crawl in someone's head and be like, aha, I see your intent.
Mm, exactly. So you have to rely on circumstantial evidence.
Like the rebate program.
Exactly, like the rebate program.
Yeah.
So you have to be really good at gathering information, asking the right questions, and putting together the pieces of the puzzle to show that fraud actually happened.
It's like detective work.
It is.
Yeah,
it's legal detective work.
I like it. Okay, so there were a couple other things that came up in this case.
Uh-huh.
Like there was this counterclaim for something called a constructive trust.
Right.
Can you explain what that is and why it didn't work out in this case?
Sure. So a constructive trust, it's basically a legal tool that courts can use to prevent someone from, you know, unfairly benefiting from something they did wrong.
Okay.
It's kind of like saying, okay, you got this property in a shady way, so we're going to treat it like you're holding it in trust for the person you wronged.
Got it.
But the thing is, to make a constructive trust happen, you have to be able to directly trace the assets, the stuff that was taken, to the property that you want put in trust.
So like a paper trail.
Exactly. You need a clear connection. And in Aztec v. Duenas, they couldn't do that. They couldn't prove that specific link. So the counterclaim failed.
Okay, that makes sense. And going back to the opinions, you know, we talked about how the judges disagreed on some things.
Yeah, the majority and the dissent, they had some fundamental differences in how they saw the evidence.
Yeah. Can you break down those differences a little more?
Yeah.
Like, what was the core of their disagreement?
Sure. So the majority, they looked at the fact that Michelle knew about the rebates and then claimed he paid for the equipment himself. And they were like, okay, this is pretty clear evidence that he was trying to deceive Ruano.
Right.
They saw that as intent. But the dissent, they focused on the whole lack of formal agreements, the casual nature of everything, and they said, hold on, this informality makes it really hard to say for sure that Michelle was being intentionally deceptive.
So they're basically saying it could have been an honest mistake.
Yeah, like maybe he just wasn't being super clear, or maybe Ruano misunderstood something.
Okay, so it's all about interpretation.
Yeah, in the end, it comes down to how you interpret the evidence within the context of their relationship and the whole informal business setting.
And the idea of justifiable reliance seems really important here.
Absolutely. It's a key legal concept.
Yeah. So even though Ruano didn't go out and investigate Michelle's claims about the equipment,
Right.
why did the court decide that it was okay for him to rely on what Michelle said?
Well, like we discussed, they considered the whole family dynamic, you know, the fact that they were cousins,
Right.
and also that Ruano was relatively new to the restaurant business. So the court basically said, look, it's reasonable for people to trust their family members.
Yeah, there's an inherent trust there.
Exactly. And especially in that context where Ruano was still learning the ropes, it wasn't unreasonable for him to take his cousin's word for it.
Yeah, he probably wasn't thinking, oh, I need to get a lawyer and do a background check on my cousin.
Exactly.
Okay, last question.
Hit me.
So we've been talking about the $75,000 compensatory award, and I know that the trial court also mentioned punitive damages, but why have we mostly focused on that initial award?
Yeah, good point. So the $75,000, that represents the actual financial harm that Ruano suffered because of Michelle's fraud. It's the money he lost directly because of that lie.
Right, makes sense.
Punitive damages, those are meant to punish the wrongdoer, you know, to deter them and others from doing that kind of thing again.
Yeah.
But the main takeaway from Aztec v. Duenas, especially for understanding how fraud works in these kinds of situations,
Right.
is that you can be held liable for the actual financial damage you cause.
Yeah. So at the end of the day, the lesson from Aztec International Foods, Inc. v. Duenas is clear.
Super clear.
Don't let informality fool you. Even if you're dealing with family or friends, get those agreements in writing.
Absolutely. It's the best way to protect yourself and prevent a handshake deal from turning into a legal nightmare.
Words to live by.
Absolutely.
So before we go, one last thought for everyone out there.
Okay, I'm ready.
We live in a world where online collaborations and informal partnerships are becoming so common.
Oh, yeah, the gig economy. Everything's changing.
Exactly. So what can we do to prevent these kinds of situations from happening in these new, less formal business environments?
That's a great question, and I think it's something we all need to be thinking about.
It's food for thought.
It is.
Well, that's all the time we have for today.
Until next time.
Until our next deep dive.